From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. Debate continues today in the Senate over voting rights legislation, which faces opposition from every Republican and two key Democrats. But Majority Leader Chuck Schumer today said long odds are no excuse to avoid the issue.
We're going to vote. We're all going to go on the record. And Republicans will have to choose which side they stand on, protecting democracy or offering their implicit endorsement of Donald Trump's big lie.
Our next guest says we should look to history to understand why Democrats are pushing forward despite that opposition, that historically support for voting rights has always been partisan. Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center and author of The Fight to Vote, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're at this critical point now with this voting rights protection legislation being debated in the Senate. The outcome seems clear. Do you see any way forward?
I think that this is a huge fight and there are twists and turns. And I would not say it's not over till it's over. I would say it's not over. There's more of a need for legislation like this than there has been in decades, but there's also more energy behind it. More political focus from the president, from the congressional leaders, and a wider movement pushing for democracy protections than I've seen in a long, long time.
Well, let's break it down a little bit. There are two key Democrats who are firmly opposed. Senate Democrats are meeting later today with Senators Manchin and Sinema to try to urge them to change the filibuster rules. Any hope there from your view?
Well, it's important to remember, first of all, that the Freedom to Vote Act and John Lewis bill, which are now one bill, the Freedom to Vote John Lewis Voting Act, has the support of all the Democratic senators. It's passed the House of Representatives. It has the support of all the Democratic senators. Indeed, Senator Manchin was a principal author of the Freedom to Vote Act. So Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin have said that they support voting rights. The question is, what will they do to actually see it passed? Right now, the choice is fairly stark.
Right.
Do you stand up for voting rights, or do you stick with a refusal to change Senate rules or make it possible for them to pass?
Right. Well, to your point there, what is the path forward? Do Democrats have any path forward if Senators Manchin and Sinema continue to side with all 50 Republicans against the filibuster change?
Well, if they continue to side with them against the filibuster change this week, it's only the third week of the year. And people, I think, are going to keep pushing on this. One of the interesting questions is, both Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema have expressed worry that it wouldn't be right to pass voting rights on a party line basis. And that's an understandable worry, but actually, if you look at history and the history of the country, it's very often, in fact, usually the case that protections of voting rights or expansion of voting rights are done by one party over the objection of another party. It's a moment like that right now.
Right. And you recently wrote a piece for Politico where you said, our history shows us that voting rights has always been expanded by one party over the objections of the other, that when it comes to American democracy, the parties don't hug it out, as you say, they duke it out, and that voting rights has never really been a bipartisan issue. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily what we all come into this thinking is the case. But from the beginning of the country, there have been folks who've wanted to have their voice heard, who've wanted to be part of the democratic process, and there have been other folks very often who've fought against them. So it is the case that in the mid-20th century in particular, you had the Voting Rights Act. When party boundaries were different than they are now, there the liberal Democrats and Republicans united to overcome segregationist Southern Democrats. But since then, the parties have kind of sorted out.
Right.
I don't think it's something to be afraid of that the parties are speaking up on this. And right now, as we all know, the Republican Party is dominated by Donald Trump and his big lie of a stolen election. For the first time, the Democrats have become energized around a fight for voting rights, to protect voting rights. And that, I think, is going to be something we see going forward.
Michael, if there is no federal action on voting rights, what impact will it have on the midterm elections this year?
If there is no action on federal legislation, the midterm elections could see significant impact with the existing laws and with new laws making it harder for people to vote. We will continue to see attacks and threats to election officials. We'll continue to hear the big lie that our democracy is rigged, that the elections were stolen. There are things people will be able to do. There are state court cases. There's organizing. But right now, it's all on the line in the halls of Congress. We see something quite extraordinary, and it's a big week in American history. States across the country moving forward with new laws to restrict the vote. Congress has the power to stop it, constitutionally and legally. The question is, does it have the political will this week? And in the weeks to come, we will find out.
Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center and author of The Fight to Vote. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The people of Hong Kong are also debating democracy and its future. This coming 18 months after the Chinese government in Beijing imposed a sweeping national security law in Hong Kong. Since then, scores of opposition politicians have been jailed. Pro-democracy campaigners have been silenced. And recently, the government has stepped up actions against an institution that many say helped make Hong Kong the financial hub it is today. NPR China Affairs correspondent John Ruich reports.
Before sunrise, one day late last month, Ronson Chan was asleep in bed, and he had a dream that there was someone at the door. Then his wife woke him up, and it turned out not to be a dream. It was the police knocking. When he went to get the door, he live-streamed it. The police showed ID and warned him to stop videoing.
The police collect my mobile phone, okay, my new iPhone, and they collect my laptop computer and one iPad that I have seldom used.
They had come as part of an investigation into Stand News, the nonprofit news outfit where Chan worked as an editor. Police also raided the company's offices, froze its assets, and arrested seven people on suspicion of seditious publication. Critics say Stand News is the latest victim in a widening crackdown on pro-democracy voices in the former British colony. Its closure followed the shutdown in June of Apple Daily, one of Hong Kong's most popular newspapers. Its founder, Jimmy Lai, and several editors were arrested. Chan is also chairman of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. He chooses his words carefully when speaking about what's happening to avoid running afoul of the authorities.
I would like to say that the environment has been changed.
The environment has indeed changed. Journalists say pressure on the media increased sharply after the national security law went into effect in mid-2020.
Media organizations came under the axe very, very quickly indeed.
Stephen Vines was a presenter at Radio Television Hong Kong and a columnist for Apple Daily.
And sitting in the studios of the public broadcaster, that became apparent literally by the day.
Management was swiftly replaced, and the new leaders, he says, were clear that they were there to rectify problems at the station. They vetted scripts and shooting schedules, and Vines says his own English-language current affairs show, called The Pulse, came under scrutiny.
From day one, we were told certain people could no longer be invited to participate in the program. Certain words could no longer be mentioned. A raft of new conditions were imposed.
Pressure mounted, and then Apple Daily was closed, sending a shockwave through the city. One editor was even arrested at the airport a few days later, trying to leave Hong Kong. That was the last straw for Vines. He moved to the UK after more than three decades of calling Hong Kong home.
I found myself living in a place where the road had suddenly been blocked and there was no way around it.
Part of what made Hong Kong, you know, what it is, was the fact that it was open and free in terms of business, you know, in terms of a, you know, an independent legal system, and in terms of its free press and free flow of information.
Keith Richburg is president of the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong and director of the Journalism and Media Studies Center at the University of Hong Kong.
So you take away some of the legal protections that people have here, and then also if you take away the free flow of information, you know, you basically don't have Hong Kong anymore. You've got Shanghai.
For its part, the government says it's not targeting journalists or media outlets, just people suspected of breaking the law. But officials have said there are limits to free speech everywhere, and Hong Kong is no exception. Richburg says the problem is it's not clear where the red lines are, and that's intentional. The work of the Hong Kong Journalists Association continues, trying to protect freedom of speech and press, and Chan, the chairman, says it'll continue even in the face of pressure and the possibility that someday the authorities may put them in the crosshairs.
I cannot say when it is the last moment, but I would like to say that we are still standing here now.
And he says they'll keep standing up for journalists as long as they can. John Ruich, NPR News.
Roblox is now the most popular video game platform in the US and Europe, played by more than 200 million people every month. It allows its users, who are often children, to create their own avatars and jump into games designed by other players. But critics say the company doesn't adequately protect kids from harassment and abuse, and that it doesn't share enough of its income with young developers who've made the platform so successful. For more, we're joined by Quentin Smith, a journalist at the outlet People Make Games, who investigated Roblox in a series of YouTube videos. Welcome to the show.
Oh, Tanya, I'm so happy to be here.
Yes, happy to have you. So parents listening to this story may already know about Roblox, but walk us through how it works. It's sort of like a metaverse for kids.
You know, that's right. It's arguably the world's most successful example of the metaverse. And it's also kind of an interesting case study in why the metaverse might not quite be the sort of glittering dreamland that some tech entrepreneurs make it out to be. So Roblox is kind of a cross between a video game platform and a social media network. It is a website where anyone can make an account in a few seconds. And I think two-thirds of American children aged between 9 and 12 now have a Roblox account. And you can log on, you can play games. Most of these games are free, at least initially. But the thing that separates Roblox from a lot of game platforms is that Roblox Corporation doesn't actually make games themselves. The way it works is that Roblox users can use the platform's free tools and free hosting to make games themselves. And Roblox Corporation has described this as the vision for the company was to allow kids to make games for other kids. So when Roblox started almost 20 years ago, I think, it wasn't possible for kids to make money. But now, as the platform has grown and evolved, it plays host to tens of thousands of young developers who are making games for the platform and making money. Mm. Some of the developers I spoke to dropped out of school age 16 to pursue a career, rightly or wrongly, making games for Roblox.
Oh, that's really interesting. And you actually also spoke with an 11-year-old developer who actually soured on Roblox after his first game flopped. Let's listen.
Even though Roblox says to encourage you to actually make games, the likelihood of you making a successful game is basically zero.
How do the biggest games on Roblox actually get made?
Well, in recent years, the biggest games on Roblox are now made by teams. So where the platform, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, had a lot of individual entrepreneurs making successful games themselves, as the platform has gotten more and more popular, the standard of the games has gotten higher and higher, which means that the most successful games on Roblox today are made by multiple people collaborating.
Mm. And how do they get paid for their work on the platform?
Well, this is where we start getting into some areas of the platform that me and my team of journalists found somewhat sketchy. So as you make sales of, you know, whether you're making cosmetic items like clothing, or full-blown games on Roblox, the money that you receive isn't actually, you know, US dollars or Great British pounds. What Roblox pays you with is the virtual currency of the platform, known as Robux. So as you make, you know, sales of your game, hopefully, you get more and more and more Robux. But it's only if you hit the minimum withdrawal amount of possessing 100,000 Robux that you're allowed to withdraw them into your real-life bank account, at which point they get substantially devalued. Roblox ends up giving its young developers a fraction of what the industry standard would be. So usually video game publishers end up taking between 30% or 11% of a game's total sales price, and then the developers receive the rest. Roblox Corporation claims to give 25% of the sales price to people. So Roblox Corporation is taking 75% of sales on the platform. Wow. But in reality, it turns out when we looked at their financial records that for every dollar that goes into the Roblox platform, just 17 cents makes it back off the platform into the pockets of the developers who are actually making the games for this platform.
Oh, so can you translate this for us? If you have 100,000 Robux and that goes into your account, what can that translate to?
That translates to $350 US, which it... And this is where the platform starts getting kind of tricky to understand, because if you were to buy 100,000 Robux, that would cost you about $1,000 US. But Roblox Corporation buys Robux from you at a lower rate than it sells them. So what this means is that kids are sort of disincentivized from taking Robux they've earned off the platform. Because if you have a huge payday because you made a successful game, you're a sort of virtual millionaire on Robux. But the moment you choose to take the Robux off the platform, if you choose to withdraw it, only at that point are your assets devalued. And this is one of the ways in which Roblox disincentivizes its young entrepreneurs from ever taking the money off the platform.
Wow. There's also something else, and that's abuse. There's room for abuse without any oversight from the company itself. You've actually covered a particularly tragic story about a 12-year-old girl who started working for a Roblox fan game creator who was in his 20s. He's accused of sending this 12-year-old sexual messages. Let's listen to what she told you on the condition of anonymity.
He was the one who started taking the inappropriate jokes in the DMs first. He kept encouraging it, saying that it was okay to make these jokes. It's not illegal, it's not breaking any laws, even though it was literally sexting.
What unfolded once this came to light was something like a Me Too moment for Roblox. How long did this controversy go on for, and what ended up happening to the alleged abuser?
Well, this is the disturbing part, because that girl who we spoke to and a lot of her friends created evidence that this other gentleman on the platform was what they considered an abuser, but they could not get Roblox Corporation to act. They spent almost a year doing things such as trying to deliver handwritten notes to Roblox headquarters because they couldn't get a result from Roblox using official channels. The user in question was making Sonic the Hedgehog fan games, and it was only after our reporting on what happened to that young girl was put onto the internet that Sega took an interest. Sega asked Roblox to take the games down because they didn't like the this abuser making Sonic fan games. That wasn't a good look for Sega. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so only then did Roblox act. But that, to me, shows that Roblox was able to act very, very quickly when a corporation got involved and on an issue of copyright, but was not apparently interested in a year's worth of desperate messages from young people asking them to take action.
Hmm. There's also even more. Roblox also features an in-game market on cosmetic items your avatar can wear. And like the real fashion world, these items can carry a lot of prestige and go for hundreds, even thousands of dollars. You actually reported that children were buying and selling these items like commodities. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, I couldn't believe this when I found out. So there are items that Roblox sells on its marketplace that only sells a limited number of, or sells for a limited time. And after those conditions are over, the only way that Roblox users can get these limited items is by buying them from one another, which means that the price becomes whatever Roblox users are willing to buy and sell them for. And so some of these items, these limited items, go for tens of thousands of US dollars, which is an absurd thing for Roblox to be marketing to young people. But it's also a dangerous precedent, because Roblox is not an entirely secure platform. There are so many of the people we talked to spoke of scammers or crime or exploits that could occur on the platform. And we spoke to one young kid who acquired a few limiteds worth several hundred dollars and immediately had them stolen from himself. We found that it's quite clearly dangerous for kids to become in possession of these items, even if they happen upon them by chance, because that just makes them the target of criminals.
When you asked Roblox for comment on these issues, what did they tell you?
So Roblox so far has become an outrageously highly valued company. As of last year, it is now a more valuable company than Nintendo. And it's gotten there partially by not acknowledging these problems at all. We had a phone call with Roblox's communications, and he had no interest in answering our questions at all. And I think that makes sense, because this company has become enormously valuable without acknowledging any of these problems. And it feels like journalists fighting an uphill battle to get this enormous company to acknowledge that it is encountering some really serious difficulties as it scales up.
Okay, Roblox earned $500 million last financial quarter. With all of that profit, is there any sign that world regulators are looking into its business practices?
You know, I'm not personally connected to any sort of regulatory bodies, but I will say that we've been absolutely blown away by the response to our reporting. We've had tons and tons of Roblox users trying to contact us saying that, you know, the problems that we've encountered are absolutely real, but also that we just touched the tip of the iceberg. And we have had our reporting picked up by websites like The Guardian and now, mercifully, NPR. So it really does feel like we've revealed a problem that a lot of people are now very energetic about trying to solve.
That's Quentin Smith. He's a journalist at the outlet People Make Games. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much, Sonia.
The Roblox Corporation declined an interview but provided a statement responding to Quentin Smith's reporting. They pointed to their policies on parental spending limits within the platform and stated that they're taking aggressive action against third-party sites that deal with valuable in-game assets. Regarding the alleged case of sexual abuse, they noted that the communication between developers described in the reporting occurred predominantly on other platforms, not Roblox. They continue on by saying, quote, "While we cannot control activity on other applications that may have less stringent safety systems and policies, we aggressively deter moving activity off of Roblox and will take action against accounts when we are made aware of policy violations." You can read their full statement on our website, hereandnow.org.
When is rural rural? Sounds like a simple question. It's not. Especially when determining which small towns and counties can get grants meant to help, well, rural Americans. Jonathan All of St. Louis Public Radio reports that some communities that strongly identify as rural can be left out.
Houston, Missouri, tucked into the rolling hills of the Ozarks, not far from the Arkansas border, is a town of about 2,500, surrounded by farmland. Its claim to fame is being the hometown of famous clown Emmett Kelly and an annual festival named in his memory. Houston struggles with infrastructure, and City Administrator Scott Avery was looking for ways to bring high-speed internet to town.
There's a federal grant that I was looking at with the broadband. There's a ton of federal grants. One of them defines rural as more than 100 miles from a metro area. Well, I'm less than 100 air miles from Springfield, so I don't qualify.
Springfield is a metro area of about 500,000, and it's an hour and 40-minute drive away on two-lane roads, but only 90 miles as the crow flies. So for that grant, this small town that prides itself on country life wasn't rural enough. About an hour north in Rolla, Missouri, it's a different story.
I'm on the pedestrian overpass above Interstate 44 at one of the four exits into Rolla. Right ahead of me is Phelps Health. It's a big hospital with its own cancer center. Off to the left, Missouri S&T. It's a high-tech research institution with 6,000 students. But this town of 20,000, it's more than 100 miles away from Springfield and St. Louis. So according to that broadband grant, this is rural.
When I look at the city of Rolla, I don't think it meets the definition, any of the definitions of rural.
Lou Magditz is the mayor of Rolla. He spends a lot of time telling people about Rolla's amenities, its airport, numerous manufacturing plants, and high tech sector. And while his city didn't apply for that particular broadband grant Houston was shut out of, Magditz doesn't shy away from grants intended to help small towns.
If a grant come down and it was tied to rural, I would probably self-justify it and by saying, you know, look, the Rolla and its periphery probably could meet that definition.
The definition of rural can take into account population, population density, distance from a big city, and even the percentage of people that travel into a metro area to work. But there is no standardization, and that frustrates and perplexes some towns and counties. But having all those definitions isn't all bad, according to some rural advocates. Bonnie Prigge heads the Merrimack Regional Planning Commission, which works with eight rural counties in Missouri. She says while the multiple definitions can be frustrating, if there was only one, some places would never qualify.
You know, right now, with the different definitions, there might be other grants that we could look at that they could qualify for. And if we had one single definition, then there may not be a grant to address that issue.
That's cold comfort for Houston, Missouri's Scott Avery. While he does sometimes get grants targeted for rural America, he and his staff of two don't have the resources to chase after opportunities, only to find his small town far off the beaten path isn't rural enough.
When we're looking at these communities and we're comparing them, one size doesn't fit all is true, but at the same time, why can't we make sure the systems are working everywhere?
And the issue of defining rural becomes more prominent as metro areas expand and small towns that were once decidedly rural become exurb bedroom communities for people who want to be close to the city but still want a rural lifestyle, at least how they define it. For NPR News, I'm Jonathan Aull in Rolla, Missouri.
One of the biggest names in finance wants companies to rethink how they define their values. BlackRock CEO Larry Fink says investing in social and environmental issues isn't about politics or doing the right thing. It can actually help companies make more money in the long run. Robin Farzad is here to tell us more. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
Hey, Tanya.
So Fink is a billionaire who runs the biggest investment firm in the world. He laid out this vision of what he calls stakeholder capitalism in an annual letter to business leaders. What's his argument?
The thinking more about just the bottom line, I mean, the mercenary bottom line, that prioritizing your workers, sustainability, decarbonization, innovation, the whole spectrum is a more worthwhile capitalism. It is interesting, Tanya, how he too has piled on against, quote, woke, which has come to, you know, mean an amorphous leftist entity that you're seeing othered elsewhere. I mean, there's just this backlash to backlash idea. So that seems to be a bit problematic.
At the same time, some environmental groups have criticized Fink because BlackRock still invests in some major polluters. How did he defend that in his letter?
I mean, he's throwing praise and spending at ESG investing, citing, for example, the brutal disruption that awaits car makers that resist electrification. But environmental groups want BlackRock to divest outright, get out of Exxon, get out of drillers. To that, he responds, divesting from entire sectors, and I'm quoting, or simply passing carbon-intensive assets from public to private markets will not get the world to net zero. And BlackRock does not pursue divestment from oil and gas companies as a policy, close quote. Mm-hmm. That remains a huge point of contention.
Okay, looking a little bit deeper at BlackRock, they also announced last week that it now manages more than $10 trillion in assets. So BlackRock and Larry Fink have a huge amount of influence in the business world. Do you think this means that this letter will have any sway?
I think there are a couple of ways of looking at it. This is both opportunity and peril for them. $10 trillion is a ridiculous vault of assets under management, reflecting both the stock market's huge bull run and the massive shift to passive investing, notably exchange-traded funds, where BlackRock is king. The problem with passively owning the market is that you have to passively own the market. If the S&P 500 owns Exxon and several drillers or, you know, textile companies linked to questionable Chinese labor, you have to own these companies. You can, however, be using your suasion behind the scenes to get them to change. And maybe, just maybe, Fink's letter here is a very public way of telegraphing that BlackRock is going to start flexing its clout that way.
You know, one thing, though, that Fink did not address in his letter is the backlash from the political right. We know that last year Texas passed a bill that would block state agencies from doing business with companies that boycott energy companies. I mean, how could that backlash dissuade companies from following Fink's advice, basically?
I mean, yeah, Texas, the likes of Texas it's a country in terms of economic clout and the Fortune 500 companies that it has. But this is a gigantic multinational with ginormous stakes, including the massive players in Texas, such as Dell, automakers. The problem is it still gets bunched and pilloried as wokeism, the leftist drivel, this stuff that Larry Fink is putting in his letter, that others want it to stay in its lane and pursue profit and shareholder return, just leave the rest to the market. He's arguing that that's just an old way of looking at the world.
Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Throughout the pandemic, we have been checking in with one restaurant, Salt, in Lakewood, Ohio, and co-owner Jessica Parkinson. In the past 2 years, Salt has weathered every twist and turn. Shutdown, layoffs, paycheck protection loans, curbside pickup, and then vaccines, and then reopening. So here's what Jessica Parkinson told us last May.
you know, you get through this crazy pandemic and then suddenly everything opens up and now we're dealing with lack of staff. We're dealing with distribution issues. Last week, I couldn't get a beer order because the distribution was out of beer. It sounds to me like everything is opening up so quickly and everybody's so excited to get out of their house. And we're just having issues with that right now.
And of course, the new issue is O is for Omicron. So let's check in again with Jessica Parkinson. Jessica, welcome back.
Hey, Scott. Thank you again for having me.
When we spoke to you about a year ago, you said, let's just get to the summer to June when everyone is vaccinated and we can reopen. How did that go and how long did that last when you were able to reopen fully and things were looking really good last summer?
We actually saw a huge influx this past summer. Full patio when the weather cooperated, and then we were allowed to go back to full capacity in the dining room, which we did. Honestly, we haven't seen any capacity issues until this surge in Omicron.
How are you doing now?
Currently, we're seeing a little bit of a slowdown. Our business actually gets quite busy from January to June. And so our numbers are down from years past. There's no mask mandate in Ohio. We have noticed, though, a lot of our customers coming back in with masks. Our staff is fully masked.
Of course, we have vaccines now. A lot of Americans have been vaccinated. Now, of course, we have a variant that is good at bypassing vaccines. Are you asking your staff members and your customers to be vaccinated?
We've never asked our staff members to do it. They have all done it on their own time. So everybody here at Salt is vaccinated. Most of us are boosted. Unfortunately, right around the holidays, a lot of our staff members got sick, including myself and my business partner.
So
we did have to close down for a little over 2 weeks. We aren't requiring vaccines of our customers. We are asking them to be masked, like I said earlier, and most of them are.
Speaking of staff, when we talked to you back in May, you said you had been washing dishes for months because you couldn't hire a dishwasher. Are you still short-staffed?
We are not. We have a great dishwasher that recently started with us about 2 months ago.
Now, let me ask you about your supply of ingredients. Anyone at the grocery store knows we have inflation in prices and goods missing from the shelves. How does that impact you and what's on your menu?
We do have issues with certain things, but most of the items that we have very lengthy conversations with our distributors to make sure that most of our items will be, if not, you know, all of our items will be in stock. Things that we've been having issues more with, not so much with the food, but with the alcohol side of things. Specifically, spirits have been really hard to get. Beer and wine, we've had some issues with as well.
Have you had to raise prices?
We have, yes.
Because of the prices you have to pay?
Yeah, I mean, the cost increase in food and product right now is through the roof. I was actually discussing this over Christmas time with my dad. We were talking about the cost of takeout boxes and containers. 3 years ago, you could buy a container for like 73 cents, and now they're like $3.43.
For one container?
For one container.
Oh, my goodness. Well, finally, Jessica, we're 2 years into this. Can you take a moment to look back? Is there anything you and your team you think handled really well in this pandemic?
I have to say that I'm really, really proud of my staff and how they've handled themselves with customers. We have really stayed tight-knit as a family. We all have dinner together. We stay close with one another. I'm very proud in the fact that Jill, my business partner, and I have stayed consistent from the beginning. We don't make rash decisions. We really sit down and talk things through with our staff because at the end of the day, it's their comfort level that means the most to us. So I'm very, very proud of that.
Jessica Parkinson is co-owner of the restaurant Salt in Lakewood, Ohio, and we've checked in with you many times, Jessica. Best of luck to you going forward as we all kind of push through this. And personal request, keep the collard greens on the menu, okay?
Thank you so much, Scott.
Southwestern Maine has long been a hotspot for vector-borne illnesses. Deer ticks first appeared in Maine's York County in the late 1980s, and the ticks, as well as the diseases they carry, have since gained a stronghold there. York County is home to the state's only human cases of the mosquito-borne disease Eastern Equine Encephalitis, or Triple E. And as the climate changes, the region could see more of these vectors and diseases. Maine Public Radio's Patty White explains.
One of the best places to monitor for ticks and mosquito-borne diseases is at deer tagging stations, like this one in the town of Wells. On a November morning, hunter Bob Perry pulls in with a deer he bagged just hours ago in the back of his truck. Fellow hunter Darren Roberts says it's covered with ticks.
Oh, yeah. Look, there's a tick right there in his face. There's a tick back there, and there was some small black ones crawling around. I don't know if that's one there, but they were crawling all over him.
The sight of a carcass crawling with ticks might make most people recoil, but vector ecologist Chuck Lubelzik from the Maine Medical Center Research Institute dives in. He uses tweezers to pluck out the ticks, which can swell to the size of a blueberry, and drops them into a vial. As Bob Perry watches, he laments how bad the deer tick problem has become.
They're terrible.
Yeah, it's gotten worse and worse. Well, I stopped turkey hunting.
They're taking the fun right out of being out, you know, going out and at any time willy-nilly decide to go for a walk in the woods. You'd think about the ticks, you know.
Within minutes, Lubelzik pulls about a dozen of them off the deer.
This is still probably the hottest part of the state for finding ticks.
During deer hunting season, researchers and partners with the Institute fan out to tagging stations across the state to keep tabs on ticks. Getting these data in a big state like Maine can be a challenge, Lubelzik says.
But by working with hunters, this gives us a very good geographic snapshot in a very short period of time where we can cover a lot of ground in the state.
Lubelzik says York County is a bellwether for the rest of the state. Deer ticks are expanding their range, and that's fueled in part by mild winters brought on by climate change. And in southern Maine, warmer winters make York County a potential home for new populations of ticks.
So I think it's only a matter of time before we see another tick, like the Lone Star tick, appearing.
The Lone Star tick, named because of its markings, has already worked its way up the eastern seaboard from Virginia to Massachusetts, bringing with it more diseases like tularemia, which causes skin ulcers. The bite of a Lone Star can also sometimes trigger an allergy to red meat. The hope is that field surveys and surveillance at deer tagging stations will find the Lone Star tick before a population becomes established, and steps can be taken to eradicate them. But Lubelzik says when he thinks about climate change, he's even more concerned about mosquitoes, which can transmit West Nile and Eastern Equine Encephalitis, or Triple E.
But it is one of those things that worries me, because Triple E, although rarer than things like Lyme disease, is much more severe for both people and animals.
About 30% of people who get Triple E die, and half of survivors have long-term neurological symptoms. So at the deer tagging station, not only is Lubelzik counting ticks, he's taking blood samples. And what they find is that Triple E, once confined to York County, is now present statewide. It's unclear why that hasn't translated into human cases. So far, there have only been 2 reported in the state. But the U.S. saw an outbreak of 34 cases in 2019, and more than half were in New England. As climate change causes warmer, wetter weather, Triple E could become a public health issue.
Mosquitoes need water, and they need heat to really flourish.
Dr. Susan Elias is also with the Maine Medical Center Research Institute. In an especially wet spring or summer, York County could serve as the canary in the coal mine, warning that Triple E is ramping up in Maine. That's why both monitoring is important, says Elias, as is management.
We have a lot of tools in the toolbox, and the hardest part is getting people to use these tools.
That means getting homeowners to remove any standing water where mosquitoes breed. Towns might need to do careful, controlled spraying. For ticks, management includes removal of invasive plants that help them flourish, such as Japanese barberry and bittersweet. It also means controlling deer populations, because that's where ticks feed so they can lay eggs.
Yeah, this one's bad. He's got his whole underside is covered.
Back at the deer tagging station in Wells, Lubelzik climbs into the back of a truck to pluck ticks from a deer brought in by Johnny Fleming and Dave Laval. Fleming says just the other day, he picked 17 ticks off himself while hunting. Laval says it's a stark contrast to their recent experience hunting for moose in northern Maine.
We had nothing on us, not one tick, and we was in the woods for a week.
That contrast between northern and southern Maine is diminishing, says Lubelzik. Stemming the tide on vector-borne diseases is difficult, he says, but it can be done if enough people recognize the importance of controlling the spread of ticks and mosquitoes and take precautions against them. For Here and Now, I'm Patty White.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.